Good morning.
Good morning.
It's really nice to be back here in this space. And I haven't been here too many times, but I already feel like I have friends here and like I'm coming back home a little bit. So I hope we can continue our relationship. I look forward to practicing with you all in the future. And I want to thank Lacey for her hard work and putting this together and for, you know, instigating this relationship. So I really, really appreciate that.
And to everybody else who is here to help pass out flyers and Jonathan get here early and helping out. Just wanted to.
Okay, yeah, definitely. Definitely. Well, this morning, I wanted to start out with a story, an ancient story, and I think it's there's several different lessons we might be able to glean from it. But maybe I'll just start with the story first, and then we'll discuss a little bit after that. This story takes place in the time of Shakyamuni Buddha, about 2,500 years ago. So the story kind of begins late in the Buddha's life. It was the last year of his life, I believe, and he was teaching in the area of Sravasti. And this was an area that he taught in often, but he had a lot of competing, so to speak, teachers. There was a lot of teachers there that were very popular, so he tended to not dine with the court, with the king and his wife, because of just for sort of etiquette reasons, he more often dined with lay people. But the king kind of wanted to change this. He wanted to make the Buddha feel more comfortable because the king actually was a disciple of his, or was interested in his teaching. So he came to the Buddha when he was in the area and said, what kind of offering is the best offering for you? Or what food is the best food to offer you, the Buddha? And he said, food offered in friendship is the best food for me. So that one little conversation was the beginning of a lot of misunderstanding and tragedy, it turns out. So the king somehow interpreted this as meaning that the Buddha would like to have family in the court, or someone that he knew, or somehow feel that there was some kind of family relationship, because he didn't realize that the Buddha had sort of renounced those types of relationships in order to develop, you know, a spiritual community. So he wasn't so he didn't emphasize his family ties as much. He didn't go by that cultural norm anymore of you know, wanting to be connected by family some way with the court. But the king interpreted it this way, so actually the Shakya clan, which is the home clan, of course, where the Buddha grew up, was nearby this area. And the king thought that, well, if I, you know, have some kind of family tie to the Shakya clan, this will make the Buddha feel more welcome and he'll want to dine with me at the court. And so he took it upon himself to ask the Shakyas to send a member of their royal family as a consort for him, to create this relationship with the Shakyas. So, unfortunately, the Shakyas were a proud people, and it's said that they descended from the son, or I believe that they were a very high ranking in the social order of the time. And they couldn't bring themselves to let one of their members actually marry into the lowly clan of this king. And But they were afraid because this king had a much larger kingdom and was very powerful and wealthy. And if they insulted him, they felt that, that he might come and invade their territory. So they devised a scheme to placate the situation. They thought one of the ranking lay people there offered one of his slave, the daughter of one of his slaves, I think, as an impostor to present to the king to say that this was a noble princess that he could marry. And so that's what they did. And the king probably, you know, he felt there was some benefit for himself in this too, because his status would be raised by being married to a Shakya princess. And or actually, I don't think she was, I take that back, she wasn't a princess. She was just a member of the clan. So any relationship with the clan at all, you know, marriage would be an elevation of status for him. So all seems to go well, and this woman is sent over, and it turns out that she becomes the favorite consort of the king and has a son. And so the son, Virudaka, is made the crown prince. He's in line for the throne. You know, little does he know that he's the son of a slave woman. And neither, you know, little does the king know that either. So Virudaka is going along fine, enjoying the benefits of being a prince, but finds it strange as he's growing up that his relationships on his mother's side don't pay any attention to him, that they never send him gifts or come to see him or any, there's no contact at all instigated by them from the Shakya clan. As where his other relatives, of course, are doting over him very much. So when he reaches 16, he insists on going to meet his relatives in the Shakya clan. And so his mother knows the score and sends servants over there to tell them, warn them what's going to happen, the Shakya clan. So they come up with a scheme to placate the young prince. They send all of their noble princes out of the way and just have some kind of little house outside of the royal court or something to meet him and set up a sort of front to make him feel welcome enough that he won't, you know, bother them anymore. So he goes and visits the king is actually there, and they set up this whole ruse to make it seem like, you know, that everything's cool, but actually it's not, of course. The whole thing falls apart when one of the king's or the prince's servants or one of his soldiers leaves his spear behind in this place, and he goes back to get his spear because he forgot it. And he finds that everyone in this boarding house cleaning all the furniture that the prince's entourage and himself sat on, cleaning the whole place, disinfecting it, so to speak, as if it were defiled, because this is a slave to them, basically, of slave blood. And so the soldier asked the people what's going on, and they spill the beans. The servants there, they're servants of the nobles, just tell them the whole story. So Virudaka finds out what's happened, and he tells his father, so the word's out, and the whole farce, you know, is seen through. So it's a crisis for the king too, because he feels now that he has to strip the prince and his mother of their status to save face and to save, you know, a scandal. So the prince, come on in. The prince and his mother are, you know, knocked down to slave status and disgraced. In the meantime, the Buddha hears about this, and he goes to the king and says, you know, this isn't necessary. These people behaved as your queen and a prince, and they were raised in such a way, they carry themselves in such a way, so the way that you behave and interact with other people and carry your role is the important thing, not the way that you were born, not your bloodline. And this was the same in the Buddha's community, of course, too. Seniority was only established by the date that you came in. So you could be a crown prince and enter his order, and the next day a slave person could come in and be his senior, you know, that person's senior, because he had none of this caste system, or he was really, to me, you know, way ahead of his time in that way. He totally disregarded this type of designation. So the king took his advice and restored the prince and his mother back to their status, their royal status. But Viradaka was incensed and vowed revenge because he was disgraced in some way, you know, in a deep, very deep way, and felt enraged and out for blood. And he vowed that someday he would find vengeance on the Shakya clan. So another part of the story, plays into this, so we'll go with that. The king's wife dies, and the king is distraught and finding it hard to cope, and he's visiting the Buddha a lot for advice and just for consolation. And his ministers start taking over, and, you know, things start going awry because the king is absent so much that other people underneath him are taking away its power and getting probably some of his wealth or embezzling or something like that. And make a long story short, there's one minister that's faithful to him, and so the others turn against him because he's the one actually acting in the king's interest, but the other ministers want to do him out so they can still do their underhanded stuff in the kingdom. And so they tell the king that this guy's against him and plotting against him, and it turns out that the king makes this plan to ambush this minister, the commander-in-chief, actually, of his army. He doesn't want to outwardly oust him because for political reasons, but he makes it look as if bandits attack him and kill him. But it becomes clear in the kingdom that, you know, this was a scandal. And it comes out, you know, because the guy's head comes back on a pole or something. The king, you know, displays that. So it becomes apparent that this was an intentional killing. And this guy's relatives are incensed. And anyway, to make another long story short, kind of, they in the end forgive him because he goes to them and asks them, you know, what was the real intention of this minister, this commander-in-chief? And they told him he was on your side, and he's actually the only one protecting your interests. And so the king is, you know, heartbroken and asks their forgiveness. And the women mostly forgive him, but he puts a guy, his nephew, or the former commander-in-chief's nephew, in charge. It puts him in his place, showing, you know, a nod to him and his lineage that this relative of this person is put back in this place. But unfortunately, this guy has not forgiven the king and has a secret vow for vengeance because he killed his uncle. So one of the times that the king goes to visit the Buddha, this commander-in-chief is accompanying him, and stands outside of the Buddha's place, dwelling place. And back in those days, when you went to visit a great teacher or a holy man, or when you visit the Buddha, you took off all of your worldly weapons, and you came in just as a person sort of stripped of your worldly status. So the king handed over all of his insignias and his royal sword and all of these royal things that held his status to this commander-in-chief. And in that time, in this place, anybody who had that stuff had the kingdom. So if you had the royal insignia or whatever it was, the standard, if you actually had that in your possession, you could claim to be king if you had some kind of claim. So this guy brings these things back to Virudaka, the king's son, and says, here's your chance to become king. And so this is how the king's son comes into power finally. And the king, it's a tragic story. The king seeks refuge with one slave servant with another king, and travels a long way and ends up dying before anyone can bring him back to power, recognize who he is. So it's a tragic death for the king. But so in the meantime, Virudaka finally has his chance to wreak vengeance on the Shakya clan that disgraced him. And so he takes his army, he raises his army and begins marching on the Shakya clan. And the Buddha hears of this, and of course this is his tribe, this is his people. So what he does is he starts sitting meditation underneath a dead tree on the path to the Shakya clan from Kosala. And Virudaka meets him and sees the Buddha there sitting zazen or sitting meditation, and says, what are you doing here? Why don't you sit underneath a cooler, you know, a live tree in town or somewhere else? And it says, the story goes, the Buddha says that the shade of one's family tree is the coolest. This is what it said that he said. So Virudaka gets the message, and out of deference to the Buddha and probably gratitude for him saving him at this time and having him put back into power, he backs off and takes his army back. So this happens again. Marching on the Shakya clan a few weeks, months later, whenever Buddha sits under the tree. Virudaka goes back. Happens three times. The Buddha goes and sits in this way and stops his people from being slaughtered. A fourth time, Virudaka marches on the Shakyas, and the Buddha doesn't sit under the tree. And the Shakya clan is massacred. A few of them escape and apparently establish another small community, but basically they're all slaughtered. So this is the end. This is, as the story goes, this is the end of the Buddhist people, the Shakya clan. So it's in the end, the story goes that also that Virudaka ends a sort of tragic death from a natural disaster, and his army is flooded away at some point too. So it's not a happy story. It's not an uplifting story, so to speak. So it's a story sort of tragic human foibles. And so I bring this up for a few reasons, but I think they're kind of like three different teaching levels that we can look at this story from. And there's a lot of sort of divisiveness in our society right now, and a lot of, I think, us and them feeling, a lot of hatred. So I thought it could be appropriate to bring this story up. Because on, you know, the first level, we can just think about the widely accepted vices of human beings that caused the tragedies here, you know. Well, first of all, it was just sort of a simple cultural misunderstanding that the Buddha would want, you know, a person related to him in the court. So, you know, a simple misunderstanding of another person's culture caused that. Greed, too, on the part of the king, because he probably wanted to increase his status with the Shakya clan or people in general by marrying, you know, into the clan. But also his paranoia, his grasping for power when he hears of the minister, the rumors that the minister's against him, and he doesn't investigate, and, you know, out of paranoia, he just kills the person, has the person killed. But there's the bigotry of the Shakya clan themselves, of course, of thinking that the king's family was below them and wouldn't deign to be associated with them in any way, really, or by marriage or any other way, really. You know, the pride of the Shakya clan, the deception that they created to avoid being massacred, but also to just to placate the general situation. And of course, then there's Virudaka, the son of the king, whose anger and the grudge that he held against the Shakyas created a massacre. But you know, I think the root of it is basically these people seeing an entire different group of people as other, you know, and less than them, and judging an entire group of people according to some preconceived idea they had of them. So the other kind of, the next level I was thinking that we could look at this story from has to do with this here. And it said, you know, the Buddha had a famous saying from one of the earliest Buddhist texts, the Dhammapada. He said that hatred is never conquered by hatred, but hatred is only conquered by non-hatred. Some people translate that as love, you know, hatred is only conquered by love, but that's a little debatable. You know, love has a lot of different meanings in Buddhism, but as far as compassion or seeing others as self, you could say that's love for sure. I think that's what he meant. Definitely meant, you know, non-hatred. So it said that this incident was the occasion of him stating that. You know, that's how the story goes. So one of the primary teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha was that the source of our suffering is clinging to a view, like a preconceived view. I mean, the biggest view that we have that we cling to is a view of our separate self. And but we can consider a self on a larger scale. There's actually, we have a lot of different versions of ourselves. You know, we have ourself as a member of our family, we have ourself as a Buddhist, or we have ourself as a Arkansan or an American. So you can sort of talk about the self on a gradually larger and larger scale that we identify it with. But this is one of the views that he felt was the cause of suffering. It's a kind of dogma to think, you know, I'm here, you're there, and I need to take care of my life as the primary thing, and I, you know, I'm number one, and we're in competition, basically, and if there's a question about who's going to get what, you know, I'm going to get mine before you, that's the main thing. So, so what he said about these views and these clinging to these views and the emotions that they bolster in us is they create this cycle of suffering. So it's mainly the view of independent self that causes this cycle of suffering. But probably many of you are familiar with this teaching. In early Buddhism, it was taken as the main point of practice that the idea is that there are these six realms of birth and death. So a person dies, and according to their karmic accumulations, what they did in their life and past lives, they're reborn into a different realm, maybe a human being, maybe an animal, maybe one of these other realms. And there's this cycle of suffering over and over again, rebirth, rebirth, just this cycle of suffering. So so you have the heavenly realm up here on the top. This heavenly realm, it says that, you know, those are the devas where everything's wonderful and you just kind of hang out in pleasure for eons. But it eventually, even though it's a very nice state, you're going to fall into one of these other realms. It could be a few thousand million years in our time, but sooner or later, you know, you're going to end up in one of these realms, one of these other realms. We have the human realm, which we're familiar with. We're all in that one for sure. The animal realm, pretty self-explanatory. In the hell realm, and this is where basically you're, you know, in agony, torture. It's kind of a tortured state. But it's not, this isn't an eternal kind of damnation thing. It's just another part of the cycle. Eventually you will leave hell and go back into one of these other realms in another birth. Then the realm of hungry ghosts. And these are, it's an interesting realm because those beings are depicted with usually a really ugly kind of being with a huge belly and a long skinny neck, this huge belly, and they can never eat enough to fill up their belly. So they're always hungry and trying to get something else, you know, trying to fulfill this insatiable desire, but they never can. And then you have another interesting one to me, the Titans or the Asuras, and these are the, it's said that they're usually fighting the devas here trying to get power, or, you know, they're always angry, fighting, focused on what they think is just and right, but they're always fighting. So the sort of aim of early Buddhism, what according to most people, is that you just practice hard enough and then eventually you can just get out of this realm, this cycle of being dragged around. If with good enough practice, or you just quit being reborn and you enter nirvana. But, you know, the Buddha, I think, and probably during his day, I'm quite sure that he understood that this, of course, applied to our, this life, that we go through all of these realms in a lifetime, in a year, in a week, in a day, maybe in an hour or a moment, we can go through many of these different realms. And so I think that's, you know, that's the real point for us. But anyway, from that viewpoint, I thought it could be interesting, you know, just to kind of think about how the different, how different, like, let's say the king's son, Viradaka, how he was transmigrating through these realms as opposed to how the Buddha responded to the situation. So, you know, he was probably in the heavenly realm up until the time he was 16. He probably had And it says, you know, probably the Buddha was too. He was a young man. He had all he could want. Wine, women, and song, so to speak. Everything his heart could desire. But somewhere, King Viridaku, I mean Prince the Prince, somewhere along the line when he was 16, started noticing something was off. So we'll just go to the time when he found out that he was a slave and was stripped of his power. Pretty sure he fell down into the hell realm. He lost everything. All the status that he had. Hi, yeah, come on in. All the status, all the wealth, everything he had, he lost here for some time. So I would say he probably was pulled down into the hell realm. Then the most obvious part too for him, the next time would be he went into this Titan realm, vowing vengeance, wanting to wipe out the powers that be, become powerful himself, take over. You know, when he went into that vengeance mode and wiped out the Shakya clan. So if we examine the story and the people in it, you can probably see all the different realms that you could say that they were in, you know. But the point is that human beings, as I say, all of us, I'm sure, have experienced these different types of realms. So we might be in the animal realm when we're basically just being driven by our basic needs for survival and, you know, sexual drives or drives for hunger, or those are kind of the bottom line. That happens sometimes. The hungry ghost realm can be when we, it might be in your career, might be some other situation that you feel that you just never can get quite what you need, quite what you want. You're always looking for the next thing to bolster your ego, bolster your status in society, whatever it might be, but somehow feeling that it's not quite enough. And that's a pretty basic teaching of the Buddha, that the normal ways that we try to get satisfied by satisfying our different emotions and desires that come up, they just pull us around in this cycle. And you might get what you want for a while. You might end up in the heavenly realm. You know, you might end up a rock star, if that's your ideal. Or you might end up a movie star or the president of a large company or whatever it might be, your particular form of it. But sooner or later, you'll lose all of it, even if it means at death. If you haven't come to the terms with what your life really means, if it's only been based on accumulating stuff to stay in this heavenly realm, at the very least, you're going to lose it when you die, because the old saying goes, you can't take it with you, and you're going to be in despair. When you start aging, you lose your beauty, you lose your intellectual capabilities, possibly. And if you haven't faced the great matter of life and death, you're just going to be falling into a hell realm, probably, or one of these other realms. So, in contrast to that, let's think about how the Buddha responded. So, for you people, for the folks that came in, you know, the Buddha basically sat zazen or meditation while an army was invading to wipe out his family, his clan, and you think about that. It's, to me, it's a very, very powerful image. And we might not quite understand it. At first, you know, when I first heard the story, I thought, how could you let that happen, you know, to his family? Because he could have raised an army. He was actually an expert martial artist. He says that in his early life he conquered or he mastered all the martial arts. So he could have been a great general, and there were lots of, you know, former soldiers in his community or other, you know, there were willing people that would have come to his aid to defend the Shakya clan with an army. But if he would have done that, basically he wouldn't have been the Buddha. He might have been a great general that went down in history, but he would have entered this cycle of, you know, samsara. He would have, even if it was a so-called just cause, he would have been back in the fray, because you think about this story and how important it must have seemed to these people to be on top and to have justice and vengeance, or, but now none of these people exist. These ancient tribes are gone. India is a completely different setup. So this is all just ancient history. And but we still have Buddhism. You know, we still have the teaching. The Buddhist practice is still with us. So I think he knew, you know, if he, his real gift was being the Buddha rather than defending any particular situation or group of people. Although, you know, he says in his statement of him saying, it's cooler under my family tree. That's the, it was clear that he didn't want this to happen. And he did three times go and practice and prevent this political situation from happening, or this political disaster. But, you know, three times was it a very significant thing for the Buddha. You ask him something three times and he would respond. It was, you know, kind of a number thing back then that, you know, you ask somebody three times and they're supposed to respond, or if you don't respond three times, that was your answer. If he would have responded on the fourth time, I think that would have said he was going to become a political person rather than the Buddha. I mean, he could have gone there five times, ten times, spent all his time avoiding this particular political situation rather than being the Buddha, you know, giving us these teachings that we're still discussing today. So, so the point isn't that he was not willing to make any statement on a social level about what was happening in the day, but he knew the underlying foundation for that was the most important thing. Because if you don't have that particular foundation, you're just going to be dragged around into one of these other realms of hatred or vengeance. So, and the image of him just sitting there, sitting zazen, in Zen Buddhism we call our meditation zazen, sitting meditation, is very powerful for us, for me. And I feel like, you know, we could have sort of a, ironically, it feels like, you know, you've got to get out of this realm, you know, this cycle here. But, I mean, I feel like he was just sitting still, you know, right there in the middle of it as it all turned around him. And his teaching actually has, the teaching in Zen is that we don't try to get out of this, but we actually realize that this is kind of all in our heart and mind. You know, what we really transform is what is in our heart and mind. And this becomes nirvana. This cycle itself, you know, becomes nirvana. And his sitting in zazen at that point was the key, I think. You know, when we sit in this posture, we have all of these emotions and thoughts coming up, feelings, experiences that usually drag us around into activity, drag us into getting vengeance, drag us into seeking sexuality or fame or whatever it might be. But in our Zazen practice, it all just comes up and it all just goes away. In my family, my Zen family's teaching, we call this just sitting, or shikantaza in Japanese. And that just means we just sit in this posture, breathing deeply through our nose with our eyes halfway or a quarter way open, a third of the way open, coming back to just this upright posture in the here and now. So we don't try to push anything away, but we don't grasp it. So you might be familiar with the Buddha's teaching that in the Four Noble Truths, he said the problem for us that creates suffering is not these things themselves, but our grasping to them as an individual self or as the reality of when the hatred comes up. You know, we grasp it and we say that's true, those people deserve to die, or those people deserve to be kept away, or some version of that. So the Buddha said the cause of suffering is a kind of a fast held view, a dogma. He spoke against dogmas too. So in the religious sense, but in a personal sense, you know, when we find that we are hating somebody and so sure that somebody is bad, no matter who they might be, actually, what they have done, if we're completely convinced that they are of a certain nature, that's not Buddhism. Because the Buddha said there's no underlying permanent way to define a person that who we are is a combination of events and phenomena that's way too big for us to understand. But he never said don't so anything goes. He said, you know, we meet a phenomenon rather than the essence of a person. So without getting too much bogged down in details, this teaching doesn't mean that we don't seek to have political, social harmony, and you know, people who are invading your country, you know, it doesn't mean that nothing is done against crime, that sort of thing. But there's a difference between discerning the most wise and compassionate thing to do in the moment and judging the situation as to its essential goodness or evilness, or judging a person according to their essential goodness or evil. The Buddha wouldn't have any of that, and you see that through this story. Some of you might know the story of Angulimala, who murdered close to 1,000 people almost, but was still accepted into the Buddha's community and forgiven, so to speak, after he came to the truth. But Angulimala still had karma. You know, he had to sort of pay the price for that, for what he did in the past. The Buddha, you know, never said that you're free from social consequences or karmic consequences. He didn't say that. But he said that there's no essential way to judge a person or a situation as good or evil in an ultimate sense. So I'm just going to go. I'll be done in about an hour or so. We don't want to go too long. I'll finish up here pretty soon. So the key to this, as I say, the Buddha sitting peacefully under the tree as a symbol of our Zazen. So, you know, our Zazen practice is something that we do. It's actually not something we do in order to make us more peaceful or make us a better person or a better Buddhist or to augment our life. But in Dogen's teaching, in my family teaching, it's a way to live your life. So Zazen is the absolute center of everything you do. So, the question is, how do we have this non-grasping, non-judgmental attitude off of the cushion too? How do we translate that into our everyday life? So how do we meet a situation without getting caught up in this wheel? So when somebody says something to us that we disagree with and seems really emotionally charged, how do we respond in an appropriate or wise, compassionate way, or just in a way that's not reactive, without getting, you know, hooked into this cycle of either hatred or judgment? So this is kind of the practice, and this is the main thing that I wanted to talk about in terms of what I think we might be able to learn from this story in today's environment. And, you know, there's so much more that can be said about this, how we actually do this. How do we bring this Zazen practice into our everyday experiences with people in political situations? But, one of the main ways to do that is just to get to know ourselves. It's kind of the third level of the teaching here, I think, of this particular story. Because, you know, we do this kind of war thing and this cycle thing not only with political groups, but with ourselves or people, other people, but this war is often, you know, going on within ourselves. So, Sawaki Roshi, who's a master in my lineage, says that, you know, sitting down into Zazen is to cease fire. So we stop the war with ourselves. So we may have an idea of who we should be in our own eyes or in the eyes of society, or an idea of who we actually are as an inferior or a superior or even an equal person. You know, what I love, that one of the earliest teachings of the Buddha is that the awakened person doesn't see other as inferior, doesn't see them as superior, he or she doesn't see them as equal. And that's all he said. You know, he didn't explain. So usually we think, oh, well, we should all just see each other as equal. But I think he was saying there, we don't see other, actually. I see you, and I'm seeing my own life, you know, when we see each other. I talked about this a little bit yesterday. We're actually all creating each other, our own experience right now. You know, I'm here giving a talk, and it seems like, you know, I'm just the guy up here giving a talk, but I'm really responding to this situation like I wouldn't be a speaker if there weren't somebody to listen to, probably, unless I just found it somehow entertaining in a way. But I usually don't do that. I'm responding possibly to the way people are responding to me. I might be saying something different according to the look on your face, whether you're falling asleep or, you know, your posture a little bit. And you're probably taking in my words, and you might be thinking it's nonsense, or you might be saying, oh, I understand maybe, or what's that guy talking about? But your experience and our experience of self is completely intermingled and we're creating, you know, each other. So I think this is one of the things that the Buddha meant when he said, when he made that statement. We're all living the same life. We're all in the same boat. When we start trying to come up with the boundaries between each other, it's really difficult when you start really looking at life closely. So addressing this war with ourselves might be, you know, the foundation for all of this. Because in the same way, you know, there's no way that we can judge the essential nature of ourselves or others. It's just about time to stop. I would like to say more about, you know, how we can bring our Zazen practice into these kinds of difficult situations. But, you know, I last time I was here, I talked about the three minds of Dogen Zenji. And you know, he talked about magnanimous mind, the mind that sees everything as the self. And he talked about nurturing mind, the mind that once you see that everything is your own life, you want to take care of it. And then he talked about joyful mind, the mind that arises in taking care of others as oneself. Because this is, he was seeing this, and I think it's true that that is sort of the highest aspiration or the highest potential for a human being, is to be an adult that takes care of his or her life as everything is part of the self, others and self as one thing. So, you know, almost any time we feel a judgmental thought or an angry or, you know, greedy or, you know, defensive thought coming up, we can be pretty much sure that we're going outside of the path if we grasp onto that. If the thought comes up, it's not a problem. You know, the problem is grasping it. So one of the ways that we really judge ourselves is to think, oh, well, if I'm having a difficult thought or judgment of somebody or an angry thought, that I'm no good. Or that's one of the ways we can say we're really off the mark in judging ourselves as a bad practitioner. But it's really not the problem. The problem is the investment in those things, and the grasping onto the separation, the grasping onto the judgment. So with our Zazen practice, I think once we understand and make that the focus of our life, the most important things in our life, we start recognizing the sort of particular habit patterns that we have in our particular body and mind, and how we get hooked. We start noticing our habit patterns. We start noticing the ways that we cause suffering for ourselves and for others. And the other part of the story is that, you know, Dogen Zenji said that we have this path of Zazen, this path of meeting everything as our own life that we walk towards, we try to learn about, and we keep walking towards that attitude or that expression. But then, you know, we fall away and it becomes apparent that we've made a mistake or we're indulging in anger or greed or delusion. But then he said, basically what you do is you just come back. And then he said, in that moment is enlightenment. That goes through the entire works, like everything we understand is that the goal is completed in that moment. So there's hope there. The problem is that we'll keep going, you know, we keep going back off again. But the other side is that that is when we do come back and practice, we have expressed it, the basic point. So he just said, you know, keep walking, trying to learn, and rooting our life deeply in practice, in Zazen practice, and keep coming back over and over again, you know, to this enlightenment of the here and now expressed as practice. All right, so it's a little bit after 11 now. I think I'll stop there talking in this vein. And usually we have a period for comments or questions if anybody had one about what I've said or anything else. Yes.
I thought the story was so interesting because Buddha obviously showed concern over his family. I mean, he wouldn't want anyone to be massacred, but he was like, the shade of your family tree is the coolest, and he was willing to draw attention to that attachment, because I might not understand that attachment very well, but I just thought it was interesting that he was claiming that attachment, and he was, in order to try and protect them. But it was, the way I saw it was, like, the prince or the king was determined, and so on the fourth time, Buddha's like, well, I'm gonna stop, because he'll just keep coming back. And if he had become political, like you said, and actively fought against him, he still would have caused more suffering, because more people would have died all those times.
Yeah, that's right.
So, that's just what I thought of that.
Yeah, it's a really good point, because there would have been, that cycle he would have entered into, and a lot of death and killing in any case, and somebody would win, you know, they might have been triumphant. There's a good chance he would have been able to raise an army that would have defeated them, mm-hmm. but every army that's ever existed is sooner or later, you know, dissipated mm-hmm. and been defeated in one way or the other, you know, and I think he knew that.
It surprised me to see in the story that Buddha had a family that was so wrapped up in bigotry and slavery and all that stuff. It seems to me, why wouldn't Buddha be talking with his family too? Because slavery is a form of violence, bigotry is a form of violence. Why Buddha would not be counseling with his family to become more balanced or become more Buddhist? If they claim themselves to be superior to their Buddha teachings, confusing. If they claim to be superior and yet they carry on these negative practices.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. It's funny that, it's said that actually the reason that the Shakyas were, I don't know if this is just legend, but part of the reason the Shakyas were so vulnerable at that time was that most of the great so-called, you know, leading people had become part of the Buddhist community. So he did teach them, and many of them became, you know, the great warriors apparently had put down their arms and gone into the Buddhist community. So I don't know the history behind it so well, but he definitely did. He had a huge influence on the Shakyas, apparently. But, this group that was left, apparently not. So I agree completely, yes.
You said it, the passive-aggressive, how they reacted to the king passively-aggressively.
Yeah.
To me, that just doesn't make sense. To me, that is a form of evil. You know, being passive aggressive, that's being sneaky, sneakily aggressive. I don't know. And they seem to think that's okay with how they did it, which brought karma on their heads.
Well, yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, you do hear the terms evil, you hear the term evil in Buddhism, but it doesn't mean an essential evil. It means something that causes suffering. You know, it doesn't mean that this is evil, this person is evil and they can't change, or there's some kind of force that can't be surmounted, you know, that's always going to be evil. It just means it causes suffering. So I would agree that murdering and bigotry is evil, you know, in that sense of the term, like it causes deep, deep suffering and karmic consequences. Yeah.
I don't know if I'm just missing the point or what, but how would his sitting be beneficial for others and, you know, that surround him? And how could that be a lesson, like, you know, Jethro was saying? Doesn't it show, like, complacency, passiveness, not doing anything, basically, but... what is the lesson, you know, from there? I mean, it seems like, okay, if I'm going through this world and everything's happening, do I just sit and not do anything? You know, obviously, someone's going to say, hey, you know,
yeah,
you can't just sit around or whatever, you know, and you got to do something about your life or, you know, make something of your life. So I guess my thing is, I'm missing the point of the sitting itself.
Yeah.
How does that?
Well,
how is that a lesson, I guess?
I mean, for me, what's inspiring to me about it is just that he actually did do something. He went out there and sat zazen, and it prevented the massacre from happening, you know, three times. But his ultimate devotion was to his practice rather than his political preferences. So there, people could argue, yeah, well, he should have gone out there and done more, I guess. I've heard that. That's a view, like it can be... I think that's a legitimate view. He should have, somehow people would think, well, he should have done more. But, you know, really, I don't know what it would have been. He was teaching the king. He taught the king's son. You know, he taught the Shakyas, and he just remained the Buddha. And to me, that was his sitting in his stillness of his own preferences for something higher. So the zazen is kind of the symbol for me of practice over, you know, violent reaction. But for me, he does do something in the story. You know, he does make an effort. But his highest effort is beyond the political situation of his day. Like he put something more important, put something above that.
Sure, we had a fantastic discussion in our weekly meeting yesterday. Mm-hmm. And to paraphrase it, we talked about something that a lot of people have been experiencing lately. We called it compassion weariness, and it was the term that we used. And it relates to, there's so much going on in our world right now. As you said in the beginning of your talk, it's divisive, separating us and then us and them, and couple that with we're barraged by this at such an alarming rate. Like literally hour by hour there are things happening and being brought to our attention that are emotionally, you know, magnetized, that pull us in. I've heard this yesterday in the meeting, and I've also experienced friends that are very compassionately weary. They can't handle this bad news, so to speak, or the tragic things that happen. And I resolved one way in the meeting. I got in my car yesterday and had forgotten there's notice of a demonstration in Little Rock yesterday morning. It was very, very much a target for compassion, and it was a very extreme political social group demonstrating in Little Rock. I can't help but wonder if the reason we might be feeling that weariness and that pull, is it because we might be looking at all these situations and going immediately outside into one of those realms and feeling that we must either do something about it, change it, or even the view of, hey, those people are different from me and that's why this happened.
Yeah.
Do you have any comments on that sort of thing that we're seeing a lot of people go through these days?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the problem. The issue is exactly as you say, the sort of somehow really going, I think for me, it's the danger is this fighting spirits, Asura realm, where you're so sure that you're right, you know, and a sense of sort of self-righteousness, or it can be another form of superiority or, you know, discrimination. And so you see how you get pulled into the realm, the very thing that you're trying to react against, perhaps, the discrimination of another group or the hateful attitude of a group, you get pulled into exactly the same thing by saying they're bad. And that's what I think the Buddha meant by, you know, hatred is not overcome by hatred. I think of a story of Blanche Hartman, a person that I practiced with in California at Tassajara Zen Mountain Monastery, and she was the abbess of San Francisco Zen Center for a while I was there. She passed away several years ago, but she began her practice in the late 60s, I think, but she was a very politically engaged during the 60s and a big activist, you know, and went to a lot of demonstrations. And one day she said it just hit her when she was facing some line of police that she really hated those guys, you know, that were trying to quash like a student demonstration or something. And she was like, yeah, I really hate these guys. And it was like, wait. This is what we're supposed to be fighting against, and we're doing it, you know, we're doing it. So the particular details of how we respond to a situation isn't as much the point, I think. Like in the story, it doesn't mean, you know, all we do is sit zazen. I think, you know, the Buddha made the best decision he could in his particular situation. But it's more not getting pulled into the realm, as Jonathan said, of hatred or judgment, that to me was inspiring, you know, about the story.
I feel like I can relate to what you're saying and to your topic as well. In my life, I had a lot of struggles, and I was very angry. And that's how I felt. It's crazy that that's how I found Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
And I got into martial arts, and I used all of my anger and all of my, like, fire, as I felt, to push me, so that I could try to become someone who can teach others so people won't hurt them. But then I have a master, and he told me, one day you're going to meet a wall. And you're going to, because I was starting to struggle. I just felt like I couldn't get past a certain level. And I wanted it, but I didn't want it for the right reasons. And so I was in the middle of, belt testing, and I was in the middle of the belt testing when I hit my wall, and I started crying. And in that moment, I went from feeling I have to learn, and I have to do this, and I have to do that,
so that I can get to this level so I can teach. But in that moment, it's like, you're not ready to teach your lessons. You're learning this right now. You know, like all these things are happening. This person's like coming at me. And in the middle of them coming at me, I was just like learning this lesson of, you're not doing this so that you can continue the anger. You're doing this so you can teach people to be safe, so you can teach them to be able to be happy and joyful in their moment and not be scared, you know? And in that moment, these particular maneuvers that I just couldn't seem to get down, I just did it. And it was like this, almost like floating, because I don't even remember everything. I just remember that at the end, it was just, you know, in that position, and it just all happened. But then I no longer felt that anger anymore. And so then the next time I went to practice, I thought, well, what's going to fuel me to keep on practicing? I don't have that anymore. I don't have that anger anymore in me. It's like, because I just used it to drive, my motivation, you know? And then all of a sudden it went from that to, because I love people, I want them, I want to teach them because I love them, not because I want them, you know, to, there's going to be hateful people out there and come against them. I want to teach them love, and I want to teach them because I love them. And one of the things I learned is sometimes inaction is actually a better action than, and it's a bigger statement and a bigger movement than just driving right through, sometimes stepping back and just watching and observing and seeing. You actually have a better opportunity to address an issue or not address, because some things don't need to be addressed. Some things will work themselves out, you know? And I feel like that's kind of, when I watch things, and I watch students, and I watch people, sometimes you want to get in there and you want to say, hey, you know, but sometimes you have to watch them and let them work itself out, and then they come into their own. It's like with children, you want to, oh, be careful, I love you, don't go too close to the edge, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, and as a parent, you want to, that's the edge. But then sometimes it's like, that's hot, don't touch it, it's hot. And they keep on, and then finally, ow, it's like,
yeah.
I could have stopped you, but I've figured maybe you just need to learn that lesson on your own. Because, and that's so, sometimes I feel like inaction is a bigger action.
Yes, that's, thank you very much for that. Sounds like a bring out away from that, a sort of letting go a preconceived idea, because that's a lot of times what we have, we can't see really what to do because we're so sure about our view, you know, of what needs to be done or what is the conventional thing to do, or to kind of just settle down and see, you know, without that being stuck up here, and also the kind of letting go, you know, of just ceasefire, and you know that transformation of that anger into something positive, you know, something. As I say, the idea isn't for in Zen isn't to get out of here, but to transform this to nirvana. You know, that samsara and nirvana are just ideas, and it's all about our practice. So it's not, you don't want to shut your anger down. You know, that's your life force. But how do you, you know, what's your relationship with it? Yeah, thank you.
Listening to that, I was just thinking, you know, I'm sure all of us have had our friends or family members or acquaintances in the last year that we've felt like Buddha is trying to sit in Zazen to try to change their thinking politically. And I'm sure myself, and I'm sure many of us as well, have had to make a decision at some point, like, I just can't do this anymore. It's disrupting my personal harmony. But my question is that just sitting, or is that something more that, like, when you're in the center of that chart, like he's sitting there in harmony, but he could be, you know, voting in harmony or protesting in harmony in that same place. Is that Zazen in general? Does it come off the pillow, like you were saying?
Yeah, I think so, absolutely, yeah. And, you know, the Buddha went out to, he could have stayed in the monastery or could have gone under the cool tree to where he normally would go and take his afternoon, you know, rest period or meditation period. But he did go into that particular spot where he knew the army would be coming, and he made a statement that got the point across. So yeah, I think that's what we do, in my view, is to, there's no particular answer of how we can respond in each situation. And you know, you can't even say that you never defend yourself either. I couldn't go so far as to say that even. I don't have those kinds of answers, of course. But the relationship with what we're doing is the most important part. Like, where is that coming from, I think, is the most important part. And if you're somehow politically engaged, you know, how do you do it without that judgmental attitude or that clinging to the hatred that comes up, that might come up, or the judgment that might come up, without clinging to that, is, in my view, is the point. Thank you. You're welcome.
I just wanted to make a comment based on something that you had said yesterday in relation to a lot of these other topics that you guys have brought up. But you mentioned our life is like being the symphony, being a part of the symphony, and we each have to find our own instrument that we play. But we all have to harmonize together in the end. But in thinking about that, as far as like what instrument am I playing, the Buddha played his instrument as a religious leader in being able to stop an army 3 times just by sitting, but I wouldn't necessarily expect to be able to do that myself.
Right.
But I can think of what else I can do. In my capacity. So I think about what you had said, and that I can't just sit there, but the Buddha was in a position where he could. But and you talked about, you know, kind of finding your instrument too. So.
Yeah, it's a great point. It's actually, thank you for that. It's an excellent point. Yeah. Yes.
I'd like to comment at this point because you couldn't be any more appropriate. For me, sitting helps me discern. If that's all.
Yes.
You sit, and when you get up, hopefully it's a little more clear, you know, what to do after that. I don't necessarily figure it out while I'm sitting there. You know? Mm-hmm. Hopefully not.
Yeah.
If I'm really sitting.
Right.
But it has definitely helped me be discerning. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I feel like there's some way, you know, that's what happens is that the shift of the center of sort of where we work from moves, because usually it's up here. We're really centered and think that we can figure it all out. But, you know, if we symbolically, it just sort of shifts somewhere, you know, in the body, or we're just not so, we're not so centered up here. So sometimes, yeah, just to let things settle down a little bit and see what's in right in front of our nose is the deal. There's so much static going on, and so many things to chase after, and so many distractions, and who can make sense of it, you know? So sometimes quietly just engaging with here and now is very, very helpful. You know, Dogen Zenji, or Sawaki Roshi, paraphrased Dogen Zenji by saying, Zazen is good for nothing. So, but a lot of people hear that and say, what? You know, I mean, but I think, you know, you can kind of sum up what he meant by is that we already have everything. You know, it's all there. And so he also had another saying, gaining is delusion, losing is enlightenment. So often we need to kind of lose our biases. We need to lose our investment in our rightness or what we know. And that's all part of the subtle shift of wave into our Zazen practice as the center rather than up here or a certain creed or idea. Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Shobhi, wanted to make a comment on two of the points that you're going to get a question and point a question as well. I spend a tremendous amount of my time studying storytelling. I like storytelling. And I run a lot of tabletop role-playing games, which are essentially storytelling. And when the president was elected, I'll never forget, there was an article posted, I believe it was on Lion's Roar, where they had insulted multiple Buddhist priests of different sects and temples and said, how should people respond to this? And the response was the common thread of, we should look at the president and those who support him and see ourselves there. And that moment, I realized that not only was I fighting the wrong battles and I was becoming that which I was fighting against, but I wasn't seeing myself as other people. And I've applied that since to my storytelling. And with your question of, is Zazen just sitting? I find Zazen in my storytelling, because one aspect of my storytelling that I've learned, when someone listens to a story and they're hearing certain things happen, like the story you told, they have expectations of what they think the character should be doing. So when the Buddha sat, I'm sure a lot of us thought, well, why the heck is he sitting? There's an army coming. You know, why is he not up fighting? And why is he not doing this? And we often don't see that in that small example of the storytelling, we are grasping at what we want the story to be. And we often say, well, he should do this. Or this would be a better response. Why would you sit under a tree? Why would you not get all these amazing warriors you have and fight against them? We're in posing ourselves and our view on what we want this story to become. And the moment that I realized this was I was running a role-playing game. And I asked my players about our story. And it was a very crucial moment where they all had an expectation what should happen next. And I said, I want each of you to tell me, and privately, what you think is going to happen next. Not what you should. And every answer was different. Mm-hmm. And then we all sat down at the table. And I realized at that moment that it was a case of each of us, when we hear things, when we hear stories, we often grasp and move out of that inner realm by hearing people and saying, okay, well, the character, okay, that's really dumb. I would have done this. Or I should move forward. And by letting go of that, it becomes a form of Zazen, because that arising and becoming, that arising of desire of seeing the story go in the direction you would like, is taking you out of that inner realm. And if you can let go of the attachment to that, And when it does rise, just let it rise. And then when it passes, let it pass. It's a very enlightening moment.
Great. Yeah, that's great. Thank you very much for that. To see it's true, you know, we really see the things happening and unfolding, and you're seeing yourself, of course, the resistance to it. It doesn't mean it's wrong. You know, we shouldn't be trying to discern the best thing to do, how to vote or how to have our voice in the society. But yeah, you really are seeing your own story, your own self unfolding in your reaction to what's going on. And it's important to start from there rather than say it's all them. You know, it's important to start from there and then take some responsibility and proceed from there. Thank you. Yes.
Quick. From looking at the samsara, I mean, it's interesting when you said that he, you know, the Buddha didn't go out of it. You know, he didn't like avoid and say, "I don't care about that. This is where I am." You know, and it's interesting when you know that to point out that he was in the middle of it. So he didn't. He sees everything that was going on, but he, you know, he, not that he's detached, but he's not attached to each one of them. So he's kind of keeping the focus there. So it's interesting because I think in the Christianity aspect too, where like say you know Jesus went out in the wilderness for 40 days and 40 nights, but he didn't just stay there. He came back. So it's kind of like. I think the Buddha was in that way too, where when he awakened, when he got enlightened, he didn't think that, oh, I was going to be, you know, people would be able to hear me.
Right.
But it's kind of like, you know, they say you're not just enlightened at one point. You're all, you know, you're always finding ways to kind of, you know, enlighten yourself. And I think it's the same with the Buddha. No.
Yeah.
He was awakened, but because of the fact that he's not attaching himself to each one. So he's kind of like rejuvenating that awakeness.
Yeah, it's the word sort of detachment can be sound sort of loaded, like you're some kind of ghost or something that, you know, doesn't really have human feelings or something like that, but it's an excellent point. But that's not what it is, because it's more. I mean, you know, I think you actually feel things more deeply because we have a lot of strategies for not feeling or feeling only what we want, and part of the scariness of letting go is that you know you have to really receive everything. But the non-grasping part is the point. So it's not a detachment like a ghost-like detachment, but it's a non, you know, it's a non-clinging. So you completely receive yourself and the situation, but don't grasp or invest in it in the way that we might, I think. It's really great too. Yeah, the thing about the Buddha, you know, not just staying under the Bodhi tree because he could have. I mean, that's the whole thing. You know, he thought, well, nobody's going to understand this. I'm just going to sit here and enjoy it. And he could have, but he wouldn't have been. There would be no teaching. And, you know, Dogen Zenji said that was the first mistake made in Buddhism, was the Buddha's first discourse after teaching, you know, to the five monks. That was the first mistake made in Buddhism.
He teaching?
Yeah, he said that was a mistake.
That caused his misunderstanding.
Well, Dogen Zenji, in his typical way, you know, of poetically iconoclastic statements, was trying to dig into a deeper truth. By saying that, you know, real enlightenment brings about enough compassion to make a mistake, and then it's not a mistake anymore. I think so. that was his point, I think. Like, this whole of Buddhism is sort of a mistake, because it's all okay. You know, we're all, as the gaining is delusion. We already have it all. But people are suffering. So you see suffering in front of you, in yourself or others, so you do make a mistake and say something, was sort of the point. That it's all okay, but wait a minute, something's going on here that needs to be addressed.
But then there's a lot of individuals who have achieved enlightenment who didn't do anything good. Is that correct?
Maybe. It could be. Or, you know, for me, that's not really enlightenment. I mean, enlightenment itself, I think, for Dogen Zenji, is the compassion part, too. We tend to think, you know, enlightenment is seeing the ultimate oneness, or, you know, just the complete peacefulness. But to me, like, who can stay at peace when you see suffering? You know, that's not really enlightenment. That's a kind of, that to me is more detachment. Like, there might be a way that we can detach like that and be truly peaceful, I suppose, and not engaged. But I don't, in my view, and I think Shakyamuni's view, by his example of what he did, and Dogen Zenji's view, that's not real enlightenment, or that's not enlightenment in the way that he talked about enlightenment and his definition of it. That that in the actual compassionate activity is itself the enlightenment too. The mistake is the part of the enlightenment, you know. So part of the mistake we make is by dividing enlightenment and delusion.
So you're saying once we become enlightened, we can never make mistakes anymore?
Well, not really. That's not what I would say. No. I would just say that we're enlightenment is something that's expressed.
Is it wrong for me to? I have my daughters, and I teach them that, because like one of them was coming home from school, and she would say, "You're so stupid, Mom. I did this, this, this," and I said, "I'm not stupid. Did you learn anything?" And she said, I learned I'm not going to do this again. And I said, well, then it wasn't stupid. It was a life lesson. And you gained something from it, so now you know.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know, I look at it like that. I mean, like, you know, they say they make mistakes or they do these certain things, and I tell them a mistake in my mind, and I'm trying to, like, you know, change my mind all the time and grow and evolve, but to me, a mistake is something that you add. You make it, and you continue to make it consciously. Like, you just do it over and over and over again, knowing that it's been the same result. Or if you have an encounter with a life lesson, and then you gain knowledge, and you grow from it, to me, that's not really, there's not a mistake. If you're learning, it's life lessons, opportunities for growth. That's kind of how I feel like I teach them that, because I don't want them to think they're full of mistakes, because they're going to constantly be growing and learning.
Sure.
So,
yeah, absolutely. Mistakes are important to a person's development, for sure. And a mistake is relative to your culture and time. And absolutely. You know, basically, Dogen Zenji said enlightenment can't be possessed by one person. So he wasn't trying to say that you become an infallible person that never makes a mistake. He was just saying that enlightenment can't be possessed by any one particular person, I think, was more... It can't be anyone's possession.
Yeah. The concept of enlightenment is often talked about as something you achieve. Like, it's a thing you do. And the Buddha's teachings, he never talked about it as an achievement. He never talked. It was more of an active action, so to speak. Because going back to the definition of karma, karma is it's essentially you do something, something happens. And intent does play into that quite a bit. But the grasping of, if I become enlightened, is a state of, this is what I was like before, this is what I'm like after. And nothing in the entirety of our lives will ever work that way. There's absolutely nothing that we do. You know, when Shoryu became a priest, I'm sure, you know, he'd had a concept of what becoming a priest is and getting the Dharma transmission, and now I've got it, I'm done. Like, you know, I'm finished, right? I never, I'm there. Yeah. And it's the same with enlightenment, because even if you did achieve enlightenment, if it was a place, it's literally going to be seconds, if not minutes, before you've been presented with something else that is, in essence, a form of suffering. And how you react to that won't be how you react to the next one, and the next one, and the next one, and the next one. And I heard a translation recently of one of the Four Noble Truths that said, it is not the cessation of suffering, it's the cessation of the desire to not suffer. And we constantly feel that. We that's what we talk about in Latin. That's what we're talking about as a place. Like, I don't want to suffer anymore. I'm tired of suffering. And if I get my life in order and I do these certain things and live this certain life, I won't suffer. And it never, ever happens. It never, ever, you know, the minute you think you change your job, your life, your friends, your relationship, your diet, where you go, what you do, the music you listen to, the books you read, the television you consume, the internet you go to, that suffering is not related to you making those decisions. You making a decision does not eliminate it and help you achieve that enlightenment. And I really like that definition. It's the cessation of the desire to not suffer. So there's a moment in Thich Nhat Hanh's film Walk With Me that I love, because, you know, I watch this movie and here's Thich Nhat Hanh, and he's this awesome dude, he's this Buddhist monk, and there's all these monks lined up to meditate, and they position the camera where you can look down the line, and Thich Nhat Hanh has his eyes closed and he's meditating, and there's one monk three or four spaces back, and he's bored out of his mind, and he's like looking around and yawning and, and I thought, you know, he shouldn't be good. Oh wait, there I go. There I go, saying that he's not meditating the right way, and there, you know, I'm imposing my desire that you should be like the guy in the front and not move.
There's also this thing where I don't know, it's like the lesson in there. Once you say you're enlightened, you're not. But you identify yourself as that, because, you know.
Well, Doug and Zizi said Buddhas do not necessarily know that they are Buddhas or care. So practice, you know, it's just a practice. Yeah, he was like, just express it. He was very tough, like, do it, express it, here and now. And whatever stage you are on the path, so to speak, beginner or intermediate or, you know, something else that you would want to gauge yourself at, if you're practicing here and now in the moment, that is it. You know, that's the point. So, yeah, all the other things are just kind of ideas that... Sawaki Roshi said, all Buddhist... scriptures are footnotes to Zazen. To practice, just do it. You know, do it now. So.
What time is it?
Oh, it's 11:47.
What time did that thing start?
Okay.
Oh, okay, great.
I want to say one thing. Oh, no. Buddha, when he was saying not to sit for the fourth time. That, to me, that shows, I get this from what Marie said, from what Jonathan said, that shows his non-attachment to the result of what was happening, because he respected the universe that happened the right way it happens, and at the same time, he respected that, but he endured suffering because he knew what was going to happen to his people. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah.
I like.
Yeah, that's right. I agree.
So that's probably just why he didn't do it the whole time. He says, well, the universe is getting me if I do this again. I'm trying to control this result, and I cannot control it.
Yeah, I think it's that's right. I mean, he felt he probably saw that he couldn't do any. He kind of let go, and he wasn't going to change the person's mind. And so, I think
yeah,
you're right.
He suffered because his people suffered.
Yeah, I would imagine, right?
Well, that's my enlightenment lesson, just for this lesson.
No, that's great. Thank you.
Thank you, Shari.
You're welcome. Thank you very much. We need to end for probably, huh?
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
As Lacey said, all of us are going to be, all of us, all of you, some of us.
It's mandatory.
I'm attaching myself. All of you are coming now.
It's a non-optional social engagement.
No, it's not. It's required. We'll be going to Collective Coffee just to meet and socialize. We did this last time, and it was very enjoyable. I think we even end up going out to eat after that as well, or sometime. So, but we'll all be there if you'd like to continue this. There's another group coming at 12:30, so we do have to pick everything up, and we'll take care of that. As a reminder, too, the Hot Springs Buddhist Society meets every Saturday from 9 a.m. till 10 a.m. in this room. You're all welcome. Yes, the donation box is here on the table. If you'd like to donate, and anything is welcome. It doesn't have to be money. So, I'm sure we'll take anything.
The library.
Thank you all for coming.
Can you talk about the library?
Oh, yeah. November 20th, Buddhism 101 at the library, the Garland.